From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is.
This is.
This is.
This is War News Radio.
I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
And I'm Anjali Kadambi.
This week on War News Radio, Words of War, we hear about a controversy surrounding leaked documents.
Then, we speak with a political science professor about his new book.
Finally, we learn about traffic in Baghdad.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
NATO members plan to announce 2014 as the new target date for the withdrawal of coalition forces in Afghanistan and transfer of security responsibilities to Afghan forces. NATO members will discuss the details of the three-year plan at a summit in Lisbon, Portugal, the largest international meeting on Afghanistan in 2010. Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who has consistently called for a more timely withdrawal, will be addressing the summit and is expected to request the plan's specifics. President Obama will also meet with Karzai on the sidelines at the summit. Overall, the U.S., U.K., and other members of the international coalition have stated that they may keep their military presence in Afghanistan past 2014 if necessary.
President Obama has begun Operation Global Shield, an international effort at regulating and decreasing the flow of ammonium nitrate to Afghanistan and the Taliban. Ammonium nitrate is the chemical fertilizer used in creating roadside bombs and other explosive devices, responsible for 2/3 of combat deaths among coalition forces. Pakistan, however, poses problems for the new efforts. Though Afghanistan has banned ammonium nitrate, Pakistan has not, and Pakistani police allow tons of the chemical shipment into Afghanistan daily. It is unclear whether border control unknowingly overlooks the chemical, or whether bribes allow such high rates of import, or both. Eventually, the U.S. would like to have detection devices at the borders, though Pakistan is not yet willing to cooperate with such plans. Operation Global Shield will ally with international organizations to regulate the chemical's flow.
Violence against Christian Iraqis escalated as 4 people were killed in 2 separate attacks in Mosul on the same day this week. These are just the latest in a string of attacks targeting Christians in Iraq, beginning with the Mass Time Massacre that killed over 60 in a Baghdad church last month. The violence has sparked protests around the world, including the gathering of thousands in Brussels on Saturday, urging for the protection of Christians in the Middle East. The Christian minority has thousands of years of history in Iraq, but many have recently fled due to the violence. Despite increased police patrols around churches, many Christian Iraqis fear the surge of targeted violence.
The Iraqiya Alliance, led by Adalawi, has voiced its recommitment to implementing a power-sharing deal so that Iraq can form a new government. Alawi and other Iraqiya members walked out on a parliament session last Thursday. They were angered that senior Iraqiya members had been barred from office because of alleged ties to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Iraqiya has accepted the misunderstanding and is now ready to move forward to implement the deal. Under the power-sharing deal, current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and President Jalal Talabani would keep their current positions.
Ahmed Gaylani, the first Guantanamo detainee to be tried in civilian court, was convicted on Wednesday on 1 count of conspiracy to destroy U.S. property. He was acquitted of 284 other counts, including murder and attempted murder, related to the 1998 bombings of 2 U.S. embassies in Africa. One of the prosecution's witnesses was expected to say Gaylani had purchased explosives from him used in the bombings. However, the witness was excluded by the judge since Gaylani produced his name under torture. Though Gaylani faces 20 years to life in prison, the Obama administration's critics have used Gaylani's hundreds of acquittals to urge for trial of Guantanamo detainees by military commission, where rules for the admission of evidence are less stringent.
A Pentagon report leaked to the Washington Post states that repealing the Armed Forces Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy would pose little risk to current military operations. Over 70% of soldiers responding to a survey sent to 400,000 active duty and reserve troops foresee little negative impact in repealing the policy. The report comes as President Obama and other leading Democrats urge Congress to abolish the policy in their lame duck session. A number of senators and House representatives previously stated they would not vote on the matter until seeing the results of the Pentagon's report. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who has stated support for ending the policy, has requested an investigation into the source of the leak.
This is War News Radio. Every aspect of the WikiLeaks story seems to make headlines in the U.S., except for the contents of the leaked reports. Sam Hirschman talked with some critics considering new aspects of the controversy.
News about Julian Assange and his personal legal problems peaked again when a Swedish court approved a prosecutor's request to detain him for questioning on a suspicion of rape, sexual molestation, and unlawful coercion. Herbert Snorrason, a former moderator of the WikiLeaks chat room, takes issue with the focus on Assange and WikiLeaks, as opposed to the meaning of the documents themselves.
I think the problem with the focus on WikiLeaks is very serious. Even in these high-profile cases, the media has done much more to look at what is this WikiLeaks thing rather than looking at the leaks and their contents.
A month after the biggest leak of documents in American military history, the Iraq war logs have faded from the headlines, at least in the United States, and the security debate lingers. But now, critics are also beginning to ask if the WikiLeaks formula is the most effective way to disseminate leaked sensitive information, and what would be the best balance between pursuing transparency and protecting national security. To provide that transparency, documents need to have useful information, but the Iraq war logs may have missed the mark. Snorrason says that WikiLeaks over-redacted the Iraq documents to save time.
I thought the release date was too early and still believe that was accurate. I did not believe that a decent redaction could be performed in that time. The redaction as it stands was performed more or less automatically by computer systems, which means that it's practically impossible to get any sense out of most of the documents. Whereas our experience from the Afghanistan files would imply that you'd really only need to redact anything from perhaps 5% of the documents. It's impossible to perform a sensible redaction automatically. You need to perform such a redaction simply by a human review, going through every single last document.
Eventually, Snorrason says his criticism of the process behind releasing the Iraq documents caused him to leave WikiLeaks after an ultimatum from Julian Assange.
Where he literally said, "If you have a problem with me, you can piss off."
Major Chris Perrin, a spokesperson for the Department of Defense, has different priorities. He says that releasing classified documents puts U.S. forces and others in danger.
Those are stolen documents that are the property of the U.S. government. They're also classified documents. They don't become declassified because of an unlawful disclosure. And those documents can put people's lives at risk. They can put innocent Iraqis or Afghans at risk, and they can put U.S. and coalition service members at risk.
Perrin also thinks the Pentagon is incredibly transparent about the conduct of the war, making the information released in the documents redundant.
I will say, with our operations, we try to give as much information as we can consistent with security and laws and regulations. We'll have reporters reporting live, sometimes on television live, showing exactly what's happening, when it's happening. We do everything that we can to be transparent and provide, especially the American people, the information that they should have about their military and what it's doing.
But Snorrason still thinks WikiLeaks provides a needed service by increasing the raw information available about the conduct of the war. He doesn't buy into the security concerns.
I'm not aware of any single instance where information has been kept secret for so-called national security purposes, where the release of that information later has substantiated those claims.
Peter Scheer, the director of the First Amendment Coalition, a nonprofit advocacy organization dedicated to free speech and open government, is also concerned about security. However, he thinks WikiLeaks' information is invaluable in the right format, when the press puts it into a story that the public can understand. The problems come when the documents are released in huge quantities on the internet.
Without WikiLeaks, I think there are things that we wouldn't know that the public ought to know. It takes these records. It receives them in a way that makes them untraceable. And then what it has been doing is making those records initially available to a select group of generally high-quality, high-caliber traditional news organization. If it would stop at that point, I think it would perform an unmitigated, pretty much unmitigated good service. But then to take the next step and put all of those records on the internet where everybody can see them, including the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, I think that's a mistake.
Perrin sees a tangible danger in Taliban access to the information.
The Taliban themselves have said that they are looking through documents to find names of Afghans who have cooperated with the coalition so that they can kill them.
Endangering the lives of Afghans and Iraqis who help American forces may be the most damning criticism of WikiLeaks. But even so, WikiLeaks shows no signs of going away. Its founder, Julian Assange, says in a recent TED Talk that it is growing faster than the organization can cope with.
Like any sort of growing startup organization, we are sort of overwhelmed by our growth, and that means we're getting enormous quantity of whistleblower disclosures of a very high caliber, but don't have enough people to actually process and vet this information.
In addition to WikiLeaks' growth, The Wall Street Journal reports it is spawning competitors. These organizations will need to examine their role in providing information and the challenges that it brings. There may always be a trade-off between providing that information to the public and the security of those on the ground. But how best to balance those concerns is still open for debate. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
This is War News Radio. Dominic Tierney is a Swarthmore professor and author of How We Fight, Crusades, Quagmires, and the American Way of War. Aaron Moser sat down with him to talk about his new book.
Dominic Tierney is an assistant professor of political science at Swarthmore College, as well as a fellow at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. How We Fight provides an examination of the patterns in America's military history and offers solutions to break these patterns. So, to start off, can you tell us a little bit about your book?
The gist of the book is an observation that while all of America's wars are unique, there are also some profound patterns in America's history of war. In other words, America's wars don't repeat themselves, but they do rhyme. And so what the book tries to do is trace some of these patterns that were true in the Civil War and perhaps are true today in Iraq, with the hope being that we can use some of this knowledge as we look ahead to America's military future.
So how do the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan fit into that tradition of American warfare?
So the heart of the book is a distinction between two types of war. The first type of war is campaigns against other countries. And these are the classic wars in American history, like the World Wars or the first Persian Gulf War, or the first few weeks of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we battled against the Taliban regime and battled to overthrow Saddam Hussein's government. So that's the first kind of war. And basically, Americans are pretty comfortable with that kind of war, and we tend to see those campaigns as crusades, in which Americans want to fight zealously, to overthrow the tyrant, and there tends to be a significant amount of enthusiasm for those types of wars, as long as they end in absolute victory. But there's another kind of war, and this other kind of war Americans have found much more difficult, and that is nation-building, or efforts to stabilize foreign countries and fight insurgents. So, for example, the Vietnam War, or the U.S. intervention in Somalia, or the second phases of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we're overseeing elections and battling guerrillas and so on. Americans tend to see this kind of campaign as a quagmire, and almost always see this type of mission as a failure. And that was true 150 years ago in America's very first nation-building mission, which was Southern Reconstruction after the Civil War. And it's also true today in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we've also grown weary of these operations. So there's a very striking difference of how Americans respond to wars against enemy countries versus nation-building or counterinsurgency missions.
At the beginning of your book, there's a quote from Brent Scowcroft, and I would pose this as a question to you. Can the U.S. use force, go to war, for carefully defined national interests, or do we have to have a moral crusade as a galvanizing event like Pearl Harbor?
Right. Well, that's the puzzle, one of the puzzles that really drives the book. So when we start fighting against another country, there is this great wave of crusading enthusiasm sweeps across America. And Americans believe that that war must end in absolute victory, unconditional surrender, and regime change. The tyrant must be deposed. Now, the problem is that in war, sometimes that is not the appropriate goal. So, for example, in the first Persian Gulf War, George H.W. Bush, back in 1991, wanted to fight a limited war for limited goals. He wanted to liberate Kuwait, but not try to overthrow Saddam Hussein in Iraq. I argue in the book that that was the smart choice, that marching on Baghdad would have created a whole host of problems. But what's interesting is if you look at American public opinion during the war, over 70% of Americans wanted to escalate the war and actually march on Baghdad and overthrow Saddam. So this creates a challenge for any American president who tries to fight a war against another country that doesn't end in regime change. Americans are not comfortable with a war fought for anything less than the grandest of goals.
On the topic of the limited interstate war, mm-hmm. How can the U.S. or any nation ensure that a limited interstate war will have lasting results? Mm-hmm. Because as we saw, we ended up back in Iraq a decade later.
Right. Well, that's true, and that's partly why it's sometimes appropriate to fight for regime change. So, for example, in World War II, there was no way we could have negotiated a deal with the Nazi regime or the Japanese that would have maintained American security. So when you're dealing with an almost existential threat like the Nazi regime in Germany, that war has to end with regime change and unconditional surrender. But that is not always the case, because the purpose of war cannot be to smite tyrants. The purpose of war is to achieve specific political goals. War cannot always end in maximum goals. And if you look at history, the vast majority of wars between countries end with limited goals. One country will grab a province or take some other gain, and they reach some sort of negotiated settlement. It's quite rare in history for war to end in total and absolute victory. That is, unless the United States is involved, in which case we have this tendency to believe that war must end with utter triumph.
In your book, you include a poster that was printed, I believe, in a German newspaper, depicting the Bush cabinet in a very interesting way. Could you just tell a little bit about that story?
Yeah, it is a fantastic story. So this is the German news magazine Der Spiegel. And in 2002, they printed a front cover basically depicting the Bush administration as popular superheroes. So George W. Bush was Rambo, Dick Cheney was the Terminator, Condoleezza Rice was Xena Warrior Princess. And what's interesting, as soon as this came out, the U.S. ambassador to Germany raced around the Der Spiegel offices, and the editors were worried that he was about to, you know, complain about the cover, or perhaps more seriously, the article inside the magazine, which was on American unilateralism and was pretty negative about it. But actually, the ambassador said that President Bush was thrilled by his depiction as a superhero crusader, and especially the body that he was presented as having on the front cover. And the Bush administration ordered 33 large posters of the image to be sent back to Washington at the request of Powell, Rice, Cheney, and so on. And then what's interesting is they did a follow-up cover 6 years later with the same superhero crusaders, but it was a very different story. They were pretty haggard-looking, beaten up. And the two covers really capture really neatly the difference in the American experience of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. In other words, how popular and enthusiastic we were while we were trying to overthrow the regime, and then how wearying we found the stabilization phase.
What is the most interesting thing in your book that no one has asked you about?
Well, that's a good question. The interesting observation is that the exact same event will look completely different to Americans, depending if that event happens in a war against another country or a war against insurgents. So, for example, in World War II, we used napalm against the Japanese, and nobody cared. But when we used napalm against insurgents in Vietnam, it was a war crime. Similarly, In World War II, when the Nazis commit atrocities against civilians, this just demonstrates how righteous our cause is. But in Iraq, if the insurgents commit atrocities against civilians, that tarnishes our cause and suggests we're losing. So this exact same events look completely different depending on whether they're framed by a crusade against another country or they're framed by a nation-building mission.
How We Fight, Crusades, Quagmires, and the American Way of War is on sale now. Check out the Facebook page at www.facebook.com/How We Fight. For War News Radio, along with James Wright, I'm Aaron Moser.
This is War News Radio. A lot has changed in Baghdad since coalition forces arrived in April 2003. Roads are still blocked off and checkpoints remain in place. All of this has created major problems for anyone traveling around the city. Bennett Gechner has more in this piece first aired in June.
Before the US-led invasion in 2003, getting around Baghdad was a breeze. But these days, it's an entirely different story. Mohammed Fadl is a government worker who lives in Baghdad. He has to deal with the problem of traffic every single day.
Commuting in Baghdad is awful. It's very difficult. There are many things that make it that way. One of them is the checkpoints on the roads to provide security for the people. Another problem is the heavily dense population and vehicles in the city. In addition to that, you have closed down roads, which create huge traffic jams.
When U.S. troops arrived in Baghdad, they were followed shortly thereafter by tens of thousands of imported cars. Baghdad's highways weren't ready for the flood of the new automobiles, nor was the government prepared for increased security threats, especially the Iraqi insurgents' weapon of choice, the car bomb. Sardar Polat, a Turkish man who works for a legal company, has been living in Iraq since 2005.
So, it is a war place, yeah. Now everybody says it's a little bit safe, but I will not. I cannot believe that. It's not a safe place. Every day you can see lots of bombs. You can hear somebody killed, somebody kidnapped.
But like Fadl said, the government's response, security checkpoints, slows traffic down even more. Marwan Kazan is an Iraqi college student who lives in downtown Baghdad. He thinks that checkpoints might be more trouble than they're worth.
They search our car to see if there are bombs, or weapons, or suspicious men or wanted men, and they are just looking. They don't do any real checking. They don't do real things, or stop the terrorists' execution or arrest the terrorists, only make us late for our college or work. I see there is no benefit of these checkpoints. All Iraqi people see that.
About halfway through my conversation with Marwan, the power in his house unexpectedly went out. He seemed unfazed by the incident, so I wasn't surprised when he told me about something else that plagues Baghdad's drivers.
I don't see more signals, and if they exist, they don't work, or it is necessary to follow police officers to organize the cars. Since there is no electricity in Iraqi streets, the signals don't work. Except in some streets, there are signals working all the time, because it's an important street.
But let's say you do manage to avoid any possible attacks. You've gone through checkpoints and navigated through busy traffic without the aid of basic signals, and you're at your destination. Now what? Are you just going to sidle up to the curb, get out, and go about your business? Chances are, your car will attract the attention of the police and won't be there when you return. Here's Polat again.
You cannot stop your car
in many places. You have to go to the parking place. The parking place. They told the government that, but I don't believe it. Mafia, like parking mafia, you know? You have to pay money to them, but not too much. $1 or $2, maybe. On the main road, you cannot park your car because the policemen or soldiers don't allow you to park there.
I asked about alternatives. Many Iraqis take taxis, but they're too expensive for everyday use. And, especially for foreigners living in Iraq, cost isn't always the biggest problem.
Normally, the taxi's dangerous. You don't know who they are, who the driver is, you know? There are no legal authorities in here. You don't know who he is. Maybe just a driver of a taxi. He can be a terrorist. He can kidnap you. You don't even know. And if you're foreign, they know you. They know that you come in from the other country.
You coming from the other country.
There aren't very many buses in Baghdad anymore, but there is a fairly extensive network of microbuses, vans that can hold up to 11 people. They don't run late into the night due to security concerns, but they're cheaper than taxis and have other advantages too. Though Fadl, the government worker, owns a car, he actually prefers taking the microbus.
Most people don't use their personal cars and use other means to commute, because if you're on the road driving your car and a bomb goes off, you're stuck and you can't leave your car in the middle of the road. But if you're using a microbus, you can exit and walk out of the mess.
Even though this affects everyone in Baghdad, employers are often surprisingly indifferent. It takes Fadl over an hour to travel the 3 miles to his work.
At work, they're not concerned about how I get there. They want me to show up for work at 8 in the morning, even if I was stuck in a bombing or something else. So if I show up late, they'll cut from my salary. They'll cut about $20 for each day I'm late.
The whole situation turns even the simplest errands or visits into, at best, major headaches. Here's Kazan again.
To visit a near neighborhood or near friend, I can walk. It's simple. But if they are in a far street, I must drive. So I don't visit my friends much, because of the time I need to travel to them, just on the weekend.
The real problem with all of this is that there's no one working on a solution. Fadl says people's complaints fall on deaf ears.
Projects to widen streets and open new ones do not exist. There are only projects to close down roads and set up new checkpoints. Every official moves with a big motorcade, and the motorcade blocks the road 15 minutes before he leaves to protect his route, while ordinary Iraqis have to wait out in the sun and heat until roads are clear.
Fixing traffic isn't something that's on the top of anyone's list right now, and it won't be until there's greater security. But on the streets of Baghdad, that's not a very simple goal. More often than not, the presence of troops doesn't improve security on the roads. Polat is often worried about safety when traveling.
When you see lots of soldiers and policemen, it means some bad thing will happen. Maybe they'll take some information, some attack will come, or somebody will explode some bomb somewhere. It's not safe. Normally, when you see lots of soldiers, it shows more safety. No. In Baghdad, no.
But people in Baghdad aren't waiting around to continue their normal lives, even if it does mean sacrificing some safety.
After we finish our job, I like to visit parts of Baghdad. I tell my friend I want to go to a safe place, and we go to some restaurant for dinner or for lunch. But I can say, it's not too much safety. When you sit in Baghdad, you cannot feel you are safe.
For War News Radio, I'm Bennett Gechner.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Lewis Katz, Rosanna Kim, and Amandine Lee. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Anjali Kadambi.
And I'm Eliana Biscard-Church. Until next time, thanks for listening.